Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Dennis Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. So we're going to be starting off today with a discussion of Jacob Zuma's most recent shenanigans. This is a scandal that is just not going away for the MK party, it seems. We've already seen Duduzile Zuma resign from Parliament due to her connection to the scandal. I'm, of course, talking about the fact that allegedly Duduzile Zuma basically trafficked a number of men over to Russia to fight the invasion of Ukraine. And those guys say they were tricked into joining. They didn't mean to join. We don't know if that's true. And that they are seeking a way home, but they are currently in the combat zone and so are struggling to get out of the country. They are also very possibly in contravention of Africa's anti-mercenary laws as well, depending on how willing they were as participants. But someone is guilty of a crime at some point here. The news has been getting kind of worse for Zuma. So when the story originally broke, there was a discussion that Zuma had written a letter, which was leaked to the media, describing where he apparently wrote this letter to the defense minister of the Russian Federation, asking for basically clemency for these guys and for them to be released from the army, and that they were just supposed to be doing military training. They were never supposed to go and fight on the front line. They weren't ready for it. He was apparently ignored. There was reporting in the Sunday Times that when Zuma visited Russia in September of this year, it ended in humiliation and failure. In fact, the headline is Zuma was blue-ticked by Russia. Visited Moscow in September to secure the release of these guys. Apparently denied meetings with President Vladimir Putin and Defense Minister Andrei Brusilov, and was instead told to speak to a junior official who said, "Submit your request." In writing, he sent two letters to Belousov on an MK party letterhead, asking for the request, the release of these guys. In one of the line of the letter, he said these children couldn't his late brother's wife said that the guys who were sent over couldn't even handle a gun when they were recruited under false pretenses. And recently, and we'll cover this in the second part of this topic, five suspects connected to this, including a media personality and four men en route to Russia via the UAE, were arrested at OR Tambo International Airport. The presidency, through its spokesperson, has said that the situation is complex and sensitive, not least because the individuals are reportedly in an active combat zone. We are handling this matter with discretion and urgency. These are people's lives. For the safety of those involved and the integrity of the process, we cannot provide further operational details. The well-being of South African citizens abroad remains a key priority. Terence, this is continuing to be quite a mess, and it seems that Zuma does not have the swagger that he perhaps thinks he does overseas.
No, I think that when you're looking from a particular vantage point, you might be apt to believing that things close to you are larger than they appear, but it's something of an optical illusion. I think this is a mistake that South Africa has often made with its diplomatic positioning, the idea that we are somehow the center of the universe. And I suspect that for President Zuma, who I think really well, he initially invested a great deal in BRICS. I don't think, and Anthony Butler wrote in a comment around about 2010 that it's an initiative that allows him to seem like a serious statesman. Now, and I think that's what gave him the sense that he had a particular weight in Moscow. And I'm sure that the Russians were happy to capitalize on that, but I think they can also look around now at the lay of the land and see, well, is the MK party a serious contender for power? Probably not, because it is dreadfully badly institutionalized. So it very much depends on whether Zuma himself can hang in there and on his personality. And frankly, I think they've got as much sympathy as they need from the ANC itself. So they've kind of got the genuine article with its hands on the tiller. Remember that when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a kind of reflexive media statement that Russia should withdraw, and then apparently at the personal insistence of President Ramaphosa, it was withdrawn. They don't need MK to do that. Yes, you know, MK is useful, good to keep your fingers in multiple pies. But they can get the influence they need elsewhere. It's been widely suggested that Russian financial support for the ANC continues. I think far more, and I find that actually a more plausible contention than that the ANC is getting loads of money from Iran. He wings it over there and discovers that actually he's not such a big game in town, and they are perhaps willing to snub our esteemed former president in exchange for 17 more warm bodies and perhaps soon to be cold bodies in the front line. They have their own lists of priorities, and I don't think South Africa is really one of them.
And this, I'm sure, is a bit of a setback for Zuma, not just because it's kind of embarrassing that this is coming out, but Zuma seems to have been trying to carry on an entire sort of parallel foreign policies. You know, recently visited the military junta in Burkina Faso, I presume for asking them for some sort of material assistance, I wouldn't be surprised, and various other places. And for him to be so sort of aggressively ignored like this suggests that that policy, as secretive and as menacing as it might sound, actually probably isn't producing a lot in the way of results.
Yeah. Let me just push back very ever so gently on this, that these days it's not uncommon for parallel foreign policies to be undertaken. DA effectively has their own Solidarity AfriForum. They're also doing their own thing. City of Cape Town. And this is not unique to South Africa either. Or around the world, political parties set up their own networks, and subnational governments often position themselves very differently from.
You have that bizarre phenomenon of like a city in the Midwest in America declaring its like full support for the people of Palestine or something, sort of entirely detached.
Sure, yeah.
Whatever the government itself is actually doing.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a whole sort of leg of the of climate change activism that is just focused on cities. That's a bit of a tangent. But, yes, those parallel initiatives can be influential depending on how well they are undertaken and who's undertaking them. I suspect that, as with most of his politics, President Zuma has staked everything on his personal appeal. And that's essentially MK. And I think the idea that he and Vladimir Putin were sold buddies was something that he banked on. I think it's one of these things. You know, Putin is just not that into you. This relationship means more to you than it does to him. You know, as we were saying, there's a wonderful quote about the French Bourbons. They had forgotten nothing and learned nothing. You know, there's a boundless track of obsession with a history that, you know, unfortunately, I think many of our political class don't fully understand. But having not actually, but refusing to learn any actual lessons from it, aside from what is personally appealing and validating. Look, and I think as far as Zuma's gone, he is personally, I think, invested in getting these people back. And I think that very much gets into this personalized style of leadership that, you know, Obama will go to Russia and will bring our children back, as you know. He's not able to do that, and I think that becomes a political problem for him.
Yes. So I guess the problem is not so much with a parallel foreign policy per se, but rather the fact that I think that this is almost certainly an attempt to sort of run things to undermine the South African state. That's my suspicion as to what exactly is going on here, and not by democratic means either.
Absolutely. Strange things happen in this South Africa, you know.
Indeed. So the second part of the story, which I alluded to, is that a senior broadcaster from SAFM, the radio station, was arrested as being part of an attempt to recruit people to go off to fight for Russia. On Kululeko Mantula, who does the early morning radio program on SAFM, was arrested at OR Tambo Airport and questioned by the Hawks, apparently for facilitating the signing of military contracts by South African men to go off and fight in this conflict. She is also the co-chairperson of the Association of BRICS Journalists and was arrested alongside four men for allegedly being part of this. So, I mean, that's not terribly surprising that the co-chair of BRICS was also doing something like this, because I think BRICS... South Africa's kind of position in BRICS is always been a bit weird. We have this connection to it. We just sort of almost feel like, I think we've been included just because they felt like they needed someone in Africa to to kind of round it out. But, you know, what actual sort of institutions or benefit BRICS provides for South Africa, I think, has never been clear. And it doesn't surprise me entirely that, you know, you've got these sort of affiliate institutions of it kind of, you know, being involved in stuff like this. What do you make of all this, Terrence?
Well, I think, you know, we can ask some of our more enthusiastic viewers to keep their comments about the muckraking fake news mainstream legacy media to themselves. This is an embarrassing situation, to say the least. You know, you would hope that a journalist, irrespective of how pro or anti his or her views may be on any given topic, is able to restrain behavior, you know, not to sign up people to get involved in foreign conflicts. Look, if I can riff on your point for a second, the thing about BRICS is that it was originally conceived as a descriptive term for four of the large emerging market economies, not as some sort of alignment.
It's not an alignment, right? Brazil's doing its own thing. India and China are not on good terms with each other. And South Africa is kind of this sort of awkward, you know, small player alongside all these giants.
You know, there was a Zapiro cartoon showing the BRICS and then South Africa is the briquette. But also, you know, their political systems aren't the same. You've got one out and out autocracy, one autocracy that has fig leaf elections, India, sort of the world's largest democracy, although in recent years it's become a little bit sus.
You can call it, I think, a bit of an illiberal democracy. It's definitely still democratic, but it has a sort of quite an illiberal character to it.
Actually, just 2 weeks ago, I read a wonderful quote. They talk about in India having limited liberalism. And Brazil and South Africa both have the sort of, you know, democratic institutions, but with very bumpy periods in their history.
Corruption.
Yeah, look, and, you know, I imagine that if you had to sort of line up the media environments, you would sort of go from, you know, reasonably fair. I think South Africa's got a free media with, you know, some wobbles here and there. India also suffering, but also traditionally has had a very, very free and robust media, all the way through to China, which, you know, let's just say it's not the freest media in the world. I think maybe one of the interesting points that's not getting enough airtime on this is that prosecutions under the Foreign Military Assistance Act have been very few and far between. You know, even in respect of people going to go and serve in the Israeli army, where I think the government would love to get some convictions on
some the most famous one was that when Margaret Thatcher's son went off to allegedly go and try to carry out a coup in Equatorial Guinea. And am I remembering
the Wonga
that
coup,
when I was young?
Yes.
It was a very
Although the interesting thing there was that the if memory serves, the actual mercenaries who were mostly 3-2 battalion veterans or descendants were they made it as far as Zimbabwe, and there they seem to have been apprehended. So my suspicion is that this may have had something to do with South African policy of wanting to give Zimbabwe something of a political win. But yes, Mark Thatcher was prosecuted and effectively expelled / asked to leave the country. But the prosecuting people who've actually been fighting in or recruiting the guys to go and to go and do the fighting, that's it's been a subject of much discussion, but very little action that I can see.
Just as a complete aside, Equatorial Guinea is one of those sort of bizarre, almost totalitarian states that really doesn't get enough attention.
Yes.
It just sort of sits there on a big pile of oil money, and because it's small, everyone ignores it. But anyway, let's move on to our next topic. We're going to be talking about the city of Kimberley, more specifically the Sol Plaatje municipality, which I think has Kimberley as its capital. And like many South African cities, it is really struggling at the moment with municipal poor governance. According to a story in GroundUp, salt pans and lowlands around Kimberley are perennial lakes and flays of untreated sewage in the semi-arid region. This is in spite of court cases and directives from the Northern Cape Provincial Government, which is headquartered in the city for things to be cleaned up. A particularly bad instance of sewage problems in Kimberley was in January of 2021. There were 26 families on Ravel and Von Weber streets in Kimberley's Roodepoort suburb. They had to abandon their homes because they were flooded with sewage when a pump station broke down. The flooding, which lasted for something like 9 months, left the homes uninhabitable and occurred a year after the municipality had been warned to fix the pump station and sewage holding dam at Von Weber Street. There was a directive put out by the Department of Environment and Nature Conservation in 2020 to address the sewage spills, and a fine of 10 million rand was given to the city. But that wasn't enforced. The fine was never paid, it seems, and neither the municipality nor the provincial Department of Agriculture responded to media questions on this. These residents had to be accommodated by the municipality in other houses about 6 kilometers away. And while the families were out, this is, of course, during COVID, thieves moved in and stripped 19 of the houses. The houses were demolished. Some of those families had lived there for 20 years. One resident, a former policeman, Errol van Arder, was one of the homeowners. He said he managed to prevent his housing from being stripped by renting a house elsewhere in the suburb to accommodate his wife and children while he returned to sleep in the house every night. Being on slightly higher ground, he wasn't knee-deep in sewage like his neighbors, but he still had to wade through his front door in gumboots, and sewage was high enough to destroy all of his furniture. It took 9 months for the sewage to subside. Most of the residents had bonds of more than 100,000 rand on their state-subsidized houses. So not exactly, we're not talking about like the ultra wealthy here who had their stuff destroyed. Terrence, look, there's so many stories like this across the country. And for me, the two things that stand out about here is firstly, just like the way that poor governance directly ruins the lives of poorer South Africans. And secondly, that a fine was apparently issued here and then just wasn't enforced.
Yeah. That story also talks about 10 years, 10 years of no maintenance. This, once again, the Bourbons are apposite here. forgotten nothing and learned nothing. You know, to forgotten not forgotten the depredations of the past, and not to have put many of those lessons in. And not only that, you know, one doesn't have to go back to pre 1994. Issues with the state of our infrastructure have been sounded regularly since 1994. I remember 1997 reading about the phenomenon of lost water in Johannesburg, something like 40% of the water, probably more now, is just unaccounted for. And you think of what that means. It means we are probably paying double what we should because a lot of it just vanishes. But yeah, look, this is a particularly, I don't know, stomach-turning thing that, you know, you're literally in human waste, you know, not because one pipe burst and, you know, it was kind of a flash flood, because, yeah, for 9 months they couldn't get it together. And yeah, this isn't the mink and manure belt, if you'll excuse the phrase. You know, this is gakhat, man. No, man, it's you know, I think if I may just rant for a second, it's been said that South African politics just has no sense of shame. I mean, how do you go home, or, you know, go and have a braai with your mates on the weekend when you are in an administration that does this? You know, don't you just feel like too ashamed to like draw breath or something? But apparently not for 9 months, not when you've got to put on gumboots to get through your garden.
And you just make sure you buy a big enough BMW to block the sight of the people living in state subsidized housing having their entire lives destroyed by a flood of sewage. You know, when there's this sort of talk about, oh, we need to reform local governance and we need to like change the funding model here and we need to do this, and you know, Cyril Ramaphosa shouts at all the ANC councillors and says, "Oh, you guys are just not doing a good enough job." Like, there are structural changes that need to be made to South Africa to make it work better. But you know what we can do right now? We can follow the rules on the books. You can follow up on a fine that is supposed to be issued for not carrying out some particular maintenance that was identified as a problem a year before it actually turned into a problem. People, absolutely, everyone, you know, who ignored that, the fact that the city had already been fined, should have been fired, but I guess there was an impetus to do that because, you know, the fine wasn't carried out.
You know, there is something gravely missing in South Africa's government system and its governance. There is transformation, developmentalism, you know, like, you know, whatever other cliches you want to put in there, but actually governing. You know, before we can do racial bean counting about the contractors to surface a road, let's make sure the road is actually surfaced. By the way, a major route that I travel down almost every day has been stripped. Looks like it's sort of stuck halfway between surfacing and between being stripped down and being resurfaced. I guess someone mistakenly said this was going to be used by the G20 delegates, and they realized it wasn't. So it was like, oh, well, you guys can go, you know, yourselves. Very frustrating. All right. Very frustrating.
Yeah, no, it is. And just, you know, kind of just tragically people's lives just being kind of ruined, just, you know, for no real good reason, just kind of laziness and incompetence and a lack of shame, as you say. Okay, let us go on to our last story, and let me make this a bit of a broader discussion about South Africa's left at the moment. So the ANC has long run on a platform, particularly since Zuma, but, you know, since pretty much at least the 60s, of weakening property rights, of sort of racial restorative policies and racial bean counting, of centralizing economic decision-making in national institutions. Then had the EFF, which broke away and had pretty much the same policies, but just more. Then it had MK, which did at least, I think, add some innovative policies to all of that mixture that the ANC and EFF promised by saying that we're going to have a house of traditional leaders, which is more, which governs the country and can overrule parliament, which I wouldn't say is a good innovation. And then we've had Floyd Shivambu's Africa Mayabuya movement, which, to be fair, hasn't put out, I think, a manifesto or anything yet. But it's pretty clear that it's got the exact same suite of policy solutions as the EFF, as MK, as the ANC. However, it seems to be having some teething problems. Just 2 months after it was formed, one of its deputy presidents has resigned after its first deputy president was fired. Now, two of its deputy secretary generals have resigned from the party. The Africa Mayabuya movement said that following the resignations, that they would hold a meeting over the next 2 days to, quote, confront the challenges of our time with clarity and courage. And in a statement shared on social media, they were separating the wheat from the chaff, and that its national leadership was taking decisive steps to reconfigure its national structure. The reconfiguration signifies no mere administrative adjustment. It avows the movement's unbreakable solidarity. It affirms readiness to escalate the struggle for total freedom and emancipation now, land restitution and social justice now, said the policy's leadership in the statement. There seems to be a bit of a crisis on the South African left, to me at least. What's your take on that thesis?
Sorry, we've got a bit of a storm outside. Okay, if anybody hears hears noise in the background.
Just proving you're authentically in Gauteng.
Yeah, I am. Let me say that I think this is a case of, many bulls in one kraal. There was an appeal by the EFF. It was ideological. A lot of that, funnily enough, I think was Floyd Shivambu's influence, they did their kind of marketing very well. Julius Malema is a very charismatic man. Whatever one may think of him, MK, also taps into that kind of Zulu ethno-nationalism. Jacob Zuma has a particular fan base. What exactly was Floyd Shivambu bringing? He was Julius Malema's number two. When he decided to, abandon the farm and go and sign on with MK, probably, I think, an unwise choice from a career choice, from a career point of view. Because, in MK, it always strikes me, it's not so much a case of no one's bigger than the brand, but no one's bigger than Mshalozi. Not even the brand is bigger than Mshalozi.
If you want radical politics in South Africa, you have so many options. If you like lost causes, you can vote for the PAC. If you like the slow-moving revolution, you can vote for the ANC. If you like radical, fast, intellectual, more urban-focused revolutionaries, you can vote for the EFF. And if you like sort of more old-fashioned authoritarianism and tribal authorities as to go with your sort of radical socialism, you can vote for MK. So, what exactly were these guys? And this is my point about the South African left sort of being in this kind of crisis, is that I think that's why these parties also could just keep splitting and fighting among themselves. So many of these policies have just failed completely to change the country. And now everyone's just sort of fighting over, what to do next. And no one can agree on what the way forward is, partly because I think no one has any ideas.
Yeah, look, in a sense, we've been ideaed to death. We were actually talking about it earlier in our staff meeting, that the areas of policy where you can speak to the experts. You say, what are your recommendations? So we've been making the same recommendations for 20 years. Let me say it again. Forgotten nothing, learned nothing. There is also a certain a certain intellectual on the left. The story may be apocryphal, but apparently there was a Trotskyite group at the University of the Western Cape in the 1980s. And there were like 27 people. After their first meeting, it had split into 27 factions. And like they were all refusing to speak to one another. Somehow, I don't think that this is because of that sort of highbrow, dispute over the interpretation of what exactly Trotsky meant with this particular word.
Unfortunately,
many of those lefties, like the high class lefties, are just aren't around anymore.
Yeah, this is kind of my point, though, is that I think the last national elections were sort of misleading in this way, is that you can look at the raw numbers and you can say, well, look, you take the EFF plus MK plus the PAC plus the ANC, all together you get almost, I think it's like just short of 2/3 of the seats in parliament. And that's true, and that's a very real thing. It's one of the reasons I think why we're not seeing any kind of reform in our policy. It's just that the votes in parliament aren't there. And yet, those groups seem so chaotic. They seem to not have any bright new ideas. They seem to be constantly driven by infighting and just, you know, none of them in the latest polling seem to be on a kind of upward trajectory. What was the SRF polling that came out 2 weeks ago? ANC 37, DA 32, MK7, which is a really bad number for them, and EFF7 as well, I think, something like that. I think that result is explained by this just lack of ideas.
Yeah. Lack of ideas, and I think also many of these, the individuals certainly within these parties are seen as part of that same selfish, self-perpetuating, probity lacking, recycled political class that's sort of dragged us into the sewage spill in Kimberley. Whether your blood is black, green, and gold, or you after the MK nostalgia bucks, or you're wearing a red overall,
right?
Is it? I think that a lot of the country has just sort of had a gutsful with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And while the country may not be overwhelmingly embracing an alternative right now, I think that this particular political movement, the sort of ANC expanded universe, has reached its sell-by date. Maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect that this is a sign that in the future the country is going to be going in a different direction. A good or a bad different direction, though, is up to us as South Africans, because, you know, different doesn't always mean good.
Absolutely. Anyway.
With that, let's call it to a close. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be doing something a little bit special on Monday. We're going to be our last sort of normal episode of the year. Will be Monday next week. So we're going to do a live show at 1 o'clock with myself and a number of other regulars. We're just going to be discussing the year that was and the year ahead. Terrence, one last note before we go.
Yeah.
For those watching on YouTube, they know that your title is listed as Project and Pubs Manager. What is a pubs manager?
Pubs manager, for reasons I've never fully understood, it's always been rendered as in capital letters, as though it's a sort of acronym. It simply means publications. So in other words, the long form stuff that comes through the IRR invariably crosses my desk. There we go. There is, I'm sorry to say, no drinking establishment. There's no saloon dedicated to IRR fundraising. And, you know, you're not going to find me wearing an apron and those little, you know, shoulder, little, you know, arm clips and saying, can I pull you a pint there, governor? Not that much fun. Projects and publications manager.
Okay, good to know. My title is very unwieldy, so I don't bother putting it up. I'm just satisfied with host, although that always just makes me think of hosting a parasite, which, I don't know, depending on how much you like the show, may or may not be accurate. Anyway, with that, let's call it to a close. Thank you very much, everyone, and we'll see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.